But let's get going. There are a lot I want to show you before we begin. Let me first share my screen. For some reason, when I've shared videos since I got this new PC, it doesn't seem to work, but I'll try again. You'll tell me if it works, and I'm going to put it in the chat as well, so anyone could look at this. We've spoken a good deal about swordfish. And here's Rabbi, his name is Rav Eshner Zalman Revach. You can read all about him. He's a big kashrus guy in Israel. And he too examined the swordfish, and you'll see what he says. Well, if you don't hear any sound, let me tell you, he sees it as absolutely kosher. And I'm starting to wonder, has anyone who actually examined the swordfish really been able to come to the conclusion that it's a problem? I'm thinking that maybe this will come back one day. You know, if Schechter permits it, although I don't know, the OU and the VODs won't permit it. So maybe you need a group of rabbis, but a lot of people I know are interested. So let me see if we get sound on this.
אז אם אני רוצה לסכם, הנה בא לפנינו, מגיע כאן שוב כלי שלחות, בא לפנינו, אנחנו רואים פה את כל דג הסאוטפיש, דג החרב, הדג הזה כמו שאמרנו בתחילת הדברים, היה בו מחלוקות גדולות של הפוסקים, לכאן או לכאן, חלק אסרו, חלק התירו, היה טענות שכשהדג קטן אפשר או אי אפשר, יש בו קסקסים, אין בו קסקסים, ידוע שחכמי טנג'יר וחכמי טטואן התירו את הדג, כי הם אמרו שיש בו קסקסים, כמו שכתב הרב כנסת הגדולה, והנה לפנינו עדילה ג'ילנה שביעה, הנה לפנינו כאן יש לנו את הדג, כמו שרצינו, והנה אנחנו יכולים לראות שברוך השם אחרי שהוצאנו, יש לנו כאן קסקסים על הסכין, קסקסים יפהפיים, מושלמים, טובים, מצוינים, ועם זה בעזרת השם יתברך, אני חושב שאנחנו יכולים להגיד בצורה ברורה, שלדעת כל חכמי אותם דורות, ואיפה שאנחנו כעת נמצאים בטטואן, לא באו לידי כישלון חס ושלום, אלא ההפך הוא הנכון, הדג כשר באכילה, בלי כל ספק, בהצלחה גמורה ושבת שלום.
Hey, so could you hear that? Those who understand Hebrew, the sound wasn't so loud, but it was clear. So here you again, Ari Zavatovsky brought the swordfish to Rabbi Schechter. He brought it to Rabbi Mahmoud, and here you have, he brought it to Rabbi Tendler, and at first Rabbi Tendler sort of went back, he told me, and then later Rabbi Tendler said, no, no, it can't be. But I showed you already a previous semester of Tendler's son-in-law of Schechter Elport examined the swordfish. So it seems like it should be back on our plates again, but I'm not holding my breath for that. What else do I want to share? Okay, so I spoke about Macy's Umediach, or Madiach, I said probably the better way to do it. Here, let me share my screen here again. And so what's the difference? Those who are interested, I want to call your attention to a certain rabbi. We've discussed him in the past, from Avram Aaron Aaron Yudalevich. This is actually his entry on Kvarim.com. I love this site because people looking for their great-great-grandfather or something will Google it and find it. And then you have all these comments of people that, you know, I'm related to him, I'm disrelated, this and I, you know, Mishpacha find each other. Here's a picture, by the way, of they met with President Taft. That's on the right, that's Rabbi Yudalevitz, and on the left it's Rav Gavriel Zev Margolios. These were the Gedol Yisrael in America in the 1920s. There was a very learned individual named Rabbi Josh Hoffman, who unfortunately passed away a number of years ago. He wrote a wonderful master's dissertation on Rav Gavriel Margolios. I'm very interested in that because I want to do my project on halachic history in America. So to read the tshuvos of these rabbanim in the 10s and in the 20s, it's very important for me. But he wrote, if you have Otzer HaChachma, the very first book on Otzer HaChachma is this one, Av B'Chachma. Aleph Bet, it's the first. And he has five psukim in there, and one of them deals with Macy's and Madiach, and he explains the Machokas Rishonim, what's the difference between a Macy's and a Madiach? It's not so clear. Obviously, people lead others astray, but what's the difference? He talks about it. This is a famous book for a different reason, because the first, I've mentioned this in the past, the first psak, Chalitza, it's the longest one, that's where Yehuda Levitz argues that you can use a shaliach, a messenger, to do chalitza. That is, I forget now. The man can have a messenger, I think. The woman can do it with the man, or maybe vice versa, or both. I don't remember. But you can do a chalitza. I have to look it again. I forgot. It's been a while since I looked at it. You can do chalitza with a shaliach. And all the Gedolim came out against this and attacked it. But Rabbi Yehuda Levitz didn't back down, including when the Rogachev went after him. Rav Reuven Katz says on his deathbed, he said he made a mistake. But that's what they always say. So I don't know. That might even be an example of being, you can, twist the truth. It could be that Rabbi Reuven Katz thought that Rav Yehuda Levitz was such a great Gadol B'Yisrael. He really was a great Talmud Chacham, but a lot of people were not treating him well and looking down on him, and he was worried that maybe after he passed away, people would not give him the kavod he deserved, because there's a rabbinic expression that Shagaga Yatza Mifnei Hashalit, that even a great rabbi can make a mistake. So I wouldn't say it's impossible that Rabbi Katz would have maybe created this idea in order to spare his kavod, that he had doubts, or maybe he did. I don't know. Okay, I want to talk a bit about the name Bear. A lot of people texted me about this, or emailed me, I should say. Actually, before I get to that, two more things quickly, and then I'll get to that. I said last class... that I said, we discussed about Ashila and Haninus, so you get a telegram, the Netziv says you're an Onain until the Kavura, and his son-in-law, River Fall, and the Marsham said you're not, and you start Avelos immediately, and I said, what are you supposed to do? And I thought that really, either way you do it, it seems to be okay. If you don't have a Rav who you ask, who's giving you psak, I said I could be wrong, but I thought that if someone would open up the sefer, which you could pick whichever way you wanted, I thought that was okay. And I gave the example, and no one emailed me that I was wrong, so maybe I'm okay with that. We have Talmidei Chachamim watching us even now, so and I gave an example. I said about lighting Hanukkah menorah or Havdalah, which is it? Do you do one first or the other first? And I said, you know, whatever you do, you're right, because you have big authorities on each side. And I think I mentioned about the Chai Odom and the Mishnah Berurah. Actually, it turns out that they're both on the same side of this. But that, like the Shulchan Aruch says, that you light, you're supposed to do the menorah first and then do Havdalah. But if you look in Rav Avadya, Yechav Adas, volume 1, number 75, he quotes all the views, and it's really, you have it on both sides, different opinions. The Taz, and many agree with the Taz, disagrees, and he says that first you do Havdalah before Dakas Neiros. It seems to me, I'm not talking about in show, it seems to me that at home, the places I've been, we have done Havdalah before, the lighting the candles. That's against the Shulchan Aruch. But that's what the Taz and many others say. Interestingly, Rav Avadya quotes the Avitz, Yaakov Emdin. He has a number of cases of Yaakov Emdin where he disagrees with his father. And here he says that his father's opinion was that Havdalah goes before Dalkos Neros. And he says, I used to think that, but now I disagree and I reject the Taz and I accept the Shulchan Aruch. So I wanted to see, because I said the Mishnah Berurah. I looked at the Mishnah Berurah and lo and behold, I was actually machaving. I didn't even know the Mishnah Berurah said this, but I just gave this an example. I said, this is an example. I assume whatever you do, you're right. If you look in Hilchos Hanukkah, Siman Tov Resh Pei Aleph, the Mishnah Berurah says explicitly, says in the shul, you have to light the menorah first. But he says, when it comes to the house, he says, Avid Kamar, Avid Kamar, Kamar Avid. Whatever you do is fine. And in the Be'er Halacha, he quotes the Prima Gadim, Ein rigor al shum adam ki yesh lo al miri smoch. That whatever people do, it's fine, it doesn't matter. So I'm sort of thinking that when you have that, the same thing would apply, unless there's a, see, what my point was, that I don't think there's a settled based upon what I've seen, it doesn't seem like there's a settled minhag or settled halacha on some of these issues. So if that's the case, whatever you do, you're okay. At least, one, David asks me, David from Melbourne, I said that, separatist community placed a chevrim on entering the Bornplatz synagogue, the main synagogue of the non-separatists. And he wanted to know, what's the source of that? Well, the source is, and he found it after I told him to look as well, is in Yitzhak Breuer's, I've heard this elsewhere, but Yitzhak, you can see it in print in Yitzhak Breuer's autobiography, Darkei. It's not an official chevrim where they actually proclaimed it. They just, everyone knew, everyone who was connected and faithful to the Hirschian approach knew that there's no, that he says, we were taught to go around it. Well, that I never would have occurred to me that I would enter it. I think I heard from Professor Breuer, he said they didn't walk on the same side of the street. So that's worthwhile. Okay, now what's the story about Bayer? We're dealing with Reb Bamberger. Although today we're going to focus more on the separatist dispute. Today and next class will be more on the separatist dispute. Then we'll return to Reb Bamberger. Someone asked me, what's with his name, Bayer Zeligman? And we spoke about it. And I got a lot of comments about this. And one of, well, let me just go through it, first of all, some of the points that have been made. Well, where, first of all, this notion of having the shame hole. This secular name, the name that you don't use to be called to the Torah, where does it come from? I said that I looked quickly in Hamburger's book, and I didn't see it, but if you look in, it's in volume one, page 445. He quotes Rabbeinu Tam, who says that the non-Jews began this practice of calling Jews by other names, like nicknames. He even gives one example, where the Bela from Beautiful, which that's where you get the name Bela. And then he quotes the Rush, where the Rush says explicitly, Nagu Anachrim Ba'ashkenaz, Shakarim Ledun, what do they call them? Something Hakarav Lashon Ivri. So it's amazing. Look, these are Rishonim who tell us this is the practice. I never would have thought of this on my own, that someone's name, let's say, is Elchanan, so they would call him Chuna. Or you have all these names, and they would get, I don't know if it applies to all the names, as we'll see, but at least that's where it originates. Now, we've moved way beyond, though, the Rishonim in terms of our Shemos Chol. So I want to introduce you to another book here. Too bad that, too bad that Rabbi Kelman's not with us, because I always like to point out this individual, the Rabbi Yudo Rosenberg, because Rabbi Kelman was later rabbi in his shul in Toronto. Then he's a rabbi in Montreal. He's the one who made the golem stories famous. If you want to know the whole story about the golem, that we know it, that there was blood libels and there was anti-Semites, and therefore the Maharal creates the golem to defend the Jewish community. That's all invented by Yudo Rosenberg. You have a tradition about a golem. When that comes in, we can date it already to the early 18th century. But the idea that you have, let's say, a wicked priest, and then you the golem, and you create the golem with the holy name, and his job is to save the Jews, all that, this goes back to stories created by Yudo Rosenberg. But he was also a posek and a real Lamdin, and he wrote a book called Kriya HaKdosha. And it's all, as it says here, Shulchan Aruch on the laws of Kriyasa Torah, calling people up to the Torah, etc. And in the third part of it, he has a list here, all the kinuyim, all the names that people use. And he begins in the introduction by saying how upsetting it is to him that people are brought up, called up to the Torah by names like Dimple, Grunem, Zalman. Today, no one would think it's a problem. But remember, the old way was that you were only called up to the Torah. So your name is Shlomo Zalman, let's say, or Shneur Zalman. You're not called up Zalman. You're only called up Shlomo. And he even says people are called up by names like Sam, Max, and Isidore. Sometimes someone has a Hebrew name, they call him up like that. And he thinks this is a bizayon to the Torah. He also thinks it could give problems with Gittin later on. But I want to show you something. So he goes through all the names. So, if you look, let's see, all the different names. So he comes to Bear. This is our name. So the different names, yeah. Bear, Beryl, Berish. I guess Rav Soloveitchik's name was, I assume he had a shame chol. What do you think his father and mother called him? They didn't call him Yosef. I wasn't there, but I am certain, I have no doubt, his parents called him Beryl or something along those lines. That's his name. That's my chavrusa right now. I'm learning with someone from Passaic Kollel. His name is Beryl. But I have to ask him if he's called up to the Torah by that name. So you have Berish, Bertzia, Bertza, Berman, Bernard. So Bernard, that comes from the same root. Berman, we'll get back to Berman in a few minutes. And he gives other examples of Chinuyim. Now he says at the bottom, these are the Shem Kodesh. That is, if someone's name is Beryl or Bear, what's his Jewish, his Hebrew name, his holy name, I should say? It's either Dov, that we know, or Yisachar or Yitzchak. In other words, so we say Dov Bear, Yisachar Dov, or Yisachar, or Yitzchak, so you have to look. And he gives many examples. One thing I don't understand, maybe some of you could help me out here, is he goes to, in letter Mem, so he says Morris. The Shem Kodesh is Meir. I don't know. I know plenty of Morrises have the name Moshe. I think we have one of the Morris listening to us now is named Moshe. Moses, obviously Moshe, but Max. The Shem Kodesh is Meir? Is there a tradition that if your name is Sam, of course the Shem Kodesh is Shmuel. But is there any tradition that Max, Shem Kodesh, is Meir? That I've never heard before. And it gets, he says earlier, this I also found interesting, Alexander. He says, there is no Shem Kodesh. Kach tzarech l'krosso l'sefer Torah. Ki in lo Shem Kodesh achar. So if your name is, if you're given the name Alexander, you're not supposed to have a separate Hebrew name. That is your Hebrew name. Although today, sometimes people will be given a, that name will just be given as an English name. But in Europe, it wouldn't be. Notice after that, you have Anshul. But look under there, underneath it. Oscar. My grandfather's name was Oscar. His Hebrew name was Asher, but there's, so here it says Shem Kodesh is Asher. Oh, Yitzhak or Shabtai, that I've never heard, but my favorite is, check this out. I don't know how Rabbi Rosenberg knows this and who told him this. Charlie. The Shem Kodesh of Charlie is Menashe Shlomo Asher. Who said that the Shem Kodesh of Charlie is Menashe Shlomo Asher? That I've never heard before. So, okay. So where does it come from? The suggestion was made by one of our listeners that, if you look at the brachos that we read, last week, so for instance, Yisachar is called, it says Chamor Garem, a large boned ass, and, you didn't want to call him, anyone, you don't want to use Chamor with the name Yisachar. So they changed it to Dove. That would say why, I guess, it's Yisachar Dove, but it doesn't seem to be at all historical. In fact, I think Rachel and also Rabbi Eli Fisher wrote in. What it seems to be, first of all, is that the names, the Shem Chol was first. That if the person was named Bear, and then he got the name Dove. It's not like his name was Dove, and therefore you don't want to call him Chamor, and therefore you pick something else. That his first name was a bear. That's in fact also what Rabbi Eli Fisher says. He says the animal names for males like Zev, Tzvi, Arye, and Dove became popular in late medieval Ashkenaz, and always with German counterpart names, Wolf, Hirsch, Lay, Bear. My sense is they started as vernacular Kenyan for people with names like Binyamin, Ephraim, Yehuda, etc. And that's the case. That it's that's all the evidence. That all the evidence is that originally someone was named Bear, and only later then was this turned into Dove. And what is Bear? I mean, it's not so clear what Bear is. When we have the name Yehuda. So, Leib, obviously, because you were Gor Aryeh Yehuda. So, Leib is lion, so you would name him that. We have the name Binyamin. We see in the Brachas, Binyamin Zev. You have Zev, Zev Yitrof, Binyamin Zev Yitrof. So, understand that you had the name Wolf. So, if you're named Binyamin, So therefore, they give you the name Wolf, and then it comes back backwards into Zev. Naphtali. We know that Naphtali was fast, right? And Ratz Ketzvi. What is Tzvi? Hirsch. So it seems the evidence seems to be in Rabbi Fisher writes that he says that this is, seems to be borne out by Gittin manuals that someone whose name was Naphtali would be given name Hirsch. Naphtali Hirsch. And then later became Tzvi. So originally he was just Naphtali, and he'd be known as Hirsch during the week, called up to the Torah Naphtali. Then he became known as Naphtali Tzvi. So what about, where do you get the Dov? Where do you get Yisachar Bear? So it's not clear. It could be Rachel and others have offered, you know, because she points out correctly that in old Yiddish, German, bear had different meanings. It could mean bear, like the animal, but it could also mean to bear something, like a burden. And if you look in back in the Psukim, what does the next Pasuk say? It says, Vayet Shechmo Lispol. He bowed his shoulder to bear. So it could be that that's why what the bear connection is. Some have tried to say it's related to the Dudaim. I'm not really clear. And remember, it's not just with Yisachar. It's Yosef has that name. And so I haven't been able to find an absolute answer where about this name Bear, which would be like Bearman. Well, what is it? The man, he's a bear. It seems that the M-A-N ending there is, would be like, Lashon Chavivos, let's say, you know, I don't know what you call that in English. Like we say Yanko or something like that. So Bearman was what you called a guy whose name was Bear. You called him, you referred to him as Bearman. And then that becomes a last name. But it doesn't mean man who's a bear. A dove, it doesn't seem like that's what it doesn't mean each dove. Like Friedman, we say ish shalom. So it requires more investigation if anyone knows. Oh, thank you for that. Let us now turn to the next segment here in our unit. We finished up basically with German Orthodoxy. The last thing we did was the letter of Chaim Ozer. Robert wants to know, though, it's not clear. What did Rav Chaim say? Did Rav Chaim say, not Rav Chaim, Rav Chaim Ozer say that he couldn't decide this matter between Bamberger and Hirsch because it's not based on halacha, so he didn't paskin, or he thought it was an issue for the local rabbani? What he said is as follows, that this is an issue that cannot be decided based on pure halacha. You couldn't just open up a Shulchan Aruch and decide. If it was just a Gemara and Shulchan Aruch question, then any rabbi in Eastern Europe could have been given it. Rather, it's a matter that only the local rabbis who know the situation can decide. He also said it's not pure halacha. It's something that you need to know. He said it's hashkafa. You need to have a clear hashkafa. He doesn't say that this is not an issue for rabbanim to decide. He says that the local rabbanim are the ones to decide it. Even though it's not pure halacha, Rav Chaim Ozer definitely gives the local rabbis the authority. That's why he says this is something that the local rabbis, the problem was that the local rabbis disagreed, but he doesn't say that this is just a free-for-all. It's one of these areas that, like if you have an issue, should you go protest in Washington for Israel, that this is a question where you have to get a psaka. No, it's whatever, you know, it's not that sort of, he's not saying it's like that sort of thing. He's saying it's definitely a matter that rabbis need to decide, but I can't decide it because I'm not there. And second of all, this isn't a matter where you can simply look in the halacha and anyone can open up the book. It has to do based on your hashkafa. So obviously it's going to depend on which rabbi you ask. The last point I'll just say about Germany is that those of you who read my book might also recall that the separatist rabbis, this doesn't reflect very well in them, but the separatist rabbis at the beginning of the Hitler reign in 1933-34, they actually send a letter to Hitler in which they tried to explain that we're not like the other, the Reform Jews, we're different, and they came to see the error of their ways. But it's a little shocking today to read this, you know, faced with someone like Hitler, you're going to try to say, well, we're like they said that one of the two of the big issues that the Nazis had was they thought that Jews were controlling the economy, and also that the racial issue, you know, Jewish blood was infecting the Aryan bloodstream. So in this letter, they say that you don't have to worry about that with us because we're Orthodox Jews. We keep our stores closed on Shabbos. So we're not so interested in material pursuits. Of course, today we have billionaires who keep who are Shomer Shabbos. But and then he said, and then the letter says, and we also don't believe in intermarriage. So you don't have to worry about us. When you read this today, it's a little shocking. And you look at it, it's a little embarrassing. But understand, we can't judge. You can't judge by after the Holocaust what they were doing in the early 1930s. Remember, for them, separatism was their most, one of their most important values. And the fact that you have an anti-Semitic ruler wasn't going to make them change that. They didn't want to be in the same community with the reformers. And if the Nazis want to put them in this community, they're trying to explain to the Nazis why we don't belong in such a community with them. And if they go a little bit overboard in saying that, you know, we're not like them, maybe we can cut them a little slack. Although at the time, the community rabbis were very upset with this sort of, I guess, division of the community. It's not a fine moment in the Hirshian community's history, I would say. I do also, there's three things I want to discuss before we return to Bamberger. One, Hungary, briefly. Two, review for those who weren't with us, America. You know, we spoke in the past about separatism in America, but just review it a bit, add some points, and then the land of Israel, Rav Kook, because Rav Kook has a whole approach on this. Separatism, look, Hirsch is regarded as the apostle, if I can use that term, of separatism, and it becomes associated with his name. However, the same thing was taking place in Hungary. At the very same time that Hirsch was doing this, making his position and advocating this, the same thing was going on in Hungary. And it really reaches, maybe you could say, its apex in Hungary. In 1871, the government recognizes it. That's before Germany. It's called the Teilung, the separation. The government of Hungary, we could spend 10 classes on this. We're not going to, though. But those who want more details, this book, Jacob Katz, A House Divided, Orthodoxy and Schism in 19th Century European Jewry. He has 21 chapters on Hungary and 2 chapters on Germany. So look, what Katz did in this book on Hungary has good insights, but it was it had been done by many people. Hungary, he really did it from scratch, much of the work. The government wanted a community communal council from all the Jews and that they could deal with. We're talking about now the Austrian-Hungarian Empire. So though it's Hungary, but they were ruled by Austria. So they brought all the Jews together, and lo and behold, surprise, there's a problem, because the Orthodox can't sit with the non-Orthodox because they don't agree with certain basic principles. And the Orthodox want to make it a principle that we have to be guided by the Shulchan Aruch, and the non-Orthodox don't want to accept that. Now, you know, if you're the non-Orthodox, they could have been a little smarter. They could have said, what do you mean be guided by the Shulchan Aruch? You're not guided by the Shulchan Aruch. As we've said many times, there's lots of things that we don't do that's not guided by the Shulchan Aruch. Every week, most of us at least, we don't end Shabbos when the Shulchan Aruch says to. Well, we end earlier. Shulchan Aruch holds Rabbeinu Tam, and there's a number of, I just told you before about lighting candles. The Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah say you're supposed to do Hanukkah candles first, and I think, I could be wrong, but it seems that in my area, the minhag seems to be to do Havdalah first, and then light the Hanukkah candles. That's against the Shulchan Aruch. Even if that would have, they would have thrown that back, the Orthodox would have said, fine, you know, we will be guided by the Gedolei HaPoskim, because sometimes the Gedolei HaPoskim differ from the Shulchan Aruch. But they couldn't, so they had a separation. It's called the Teilung. And what you had after that in Hungary is you had two major communities. You had, and those of you who want to come with us, today's the last day for the super discount. There's a great discount to the Central Europe trip going to the end of January. But if you sign up today, and if you're just hearing about it now, I'm sure Rabbi Kelman will give you a couple days extra. You get an extra super discount, very significant discount, almost 20%. And so we'll hear all about this when we're in Hungary. But they had communities that were Orthodox, and the majority outside of the capital, Budapest, were Orthodox. Then you had communities that were called Neolog. Now, the Orthodox always referred to the Neolog as reformers, but they're really not reformers. If you look at them, they're more in line with the historical school, the Frankel school that we spoke about today, you know, right-wing conservative. So, for instance, in the big synagogue in Budapest, the Dohany Synagogue, they played an organ on Shabbos, but they had a non-Jew play the organ for reasons we spoke about. Radical reform, like you had in, or extreme reform, like you had in Germany, never got off the ground in Hungary. Yeah. So basically, Hungary was split, most communities, into those two groups. And in some places, you'd have both. You'd have, let's say, the Orthodox would be the majority, and then you'd have a smaller Neolog, or vice versa. However, about between 10 and 15% of the country, the Jews said, you know what? We don't want to be part of any of these groups. We don't want to be part of the Orthodox. Because what does it mean to be a part of the Orthodox? It means that you join the Orthodox organization. It's an actual organization. And they said, we don't want that. And we're not Neolog. We just want to continue the way we're doing. We could deal with like a small town, let's say. Think of a small town, and they have a shul, they're one shul, and they don't want to be part of an organization, especially an organization run by those Jews living in Budapest. You know, if you're a traditional Orthodox Jew, the Jews in Budapest, they spoke Hungarian, and they dress Western. You could even view them as too liberal. You had about between 10 and 50%. They refused to join either group, and they were known as the status quo. Status quo communities. Satmar. Satmar had a... The regular community, which is then the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Yoel, became the Rabbi, but then you had people who didn't want to be in a community where Rav Yoel Teitelbaum was the Rav. You can understand that. And they created a separate community. They called it a status quo, you know, because they weren't Orthodox and they weren't Neolog, and they had their own Dayan they appointed. The status quo communities could be anything. They could be traditional, like we would call Orthodox communities. They could be even Hasidim. Some of the Hasidim didn't want to join the Orthodox organization because they didn't want to be ruled by the so-called Ashkenazim. And then you had community status quo who would be, I guess we call them modern Orthodox. And then you had that some were even could adopt reforms. You had a variety of groups who fell under the status quo. The Orthodox response to the status quo was brutal. And very harsh, much harsher than the Neolog. The Orthodox communities declared a cheirim, a real cheirim, not a cheirim, like I said, in Frankfurt, don't go into a shul, an absolute ban. And when I say the Orthodox, I'm talking about the Gedolei Yisrael, Maram Shik, and many, many others. They gave the status quo, and there were certain Gedolim in the status quo communities, or Mayor Perlis, for example, a big Rav, and others. They said to the status quo communities, this is a battle, a Mochemes Mitzvah. And you need to join together in one group so we can have a united front against the reform. And when those communities that refused to do so, their communities were placed basically under the ban. Their rabbis were regarded as invalid. If you were a shochet in a status quo community, your shlita was invalid. These communities are completely right out of the fold. In Hungary, the word Orthodox does not mean Shomer Torah mitzvahs like it does elsewhere, like it does in America. You had plenty of Jews in Hungary who were Shomrei Torah Mitzvos, but who were members of status quo communities. The parallel would be if in America, for instance, we said, if you are not a member of Agudas Yisrael, if you're not, your shul is not a member of the Agudas Yisrael or a member of the OU, then you are not an Orthodox synagogue. That's that, and we all know of certain synagogues that for whatever reason, they're completely kosher synagogues, but they don't choose to belong to that organization. In Hungary, Orthodox was a political movement. It was not a religious movement. You had plenty of Jews who were Shomrei Torah Mitzvos 100%, but were regarded by the Orthodox as literally Michutz L'machaneh. And again, it's a fascinating story. I don't know of another example of where you have religious Jews really regarded as like heretics. I mean, you can't count them for a minyan, can't do all these things. Most of the Orthodox rabbinim, I'm not talking about the masses. The masses don't know any better. But for the rabbis, for the shochtim, they put them under very, very harsh rulings, the status quo. And like I said, some of the, you had some real big Talmidei Chachamim, and by the end, let's say by the 20s and 30s, the status quo communities were still Shomrei Torah Mitzvos, and there were a number of them. I guess you'd call them modern Orthodox. They would get rabbis from Berlin and the rabbi doctor. If you wanted to have a choir, for instance, you go to the status quo community, because in the Orthodox shuls, they did not allow choirs. I want to share with you about this something fascinating, however. We spoke about Hirsch. Hirsch, the great believer in separatism. Well, Hirsch was approached by one of the Hungarian status quo rabbis and said to Hirsch, and he understandably why he went to Hirsch, Hirsch is the great apostle of separatism. What do you think, Rabbi Hirsch, about our situation? We're a Shomrei Torah Mitzvos community. We choose, for whatever reason, we choose not to belong to the Orthodox organization. And they want to declare us as a complete heretical community, a reformist community. What's your opinion? And here is the great irony. The Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch comes to the defense of the status quo. You can find this in his Shemesh Marpeh. This was never published in Hirsch's lifetime. And the reason it wasn't was because the fear, if this was published, then the Hungarian rabbis would have regarded Hirsch as michutz l'machane, as out of the fold, as an underminer. And Hirsch himself didn't want it to be published, because he didn't want to have trouble and get into Machlokas. He saw what happened with Rezula Hildesheimer. And after his passing, they didn't publish it either. Why was it published? The Torah journal Moria got a hold of it, and they published it. And therefore, Professor Breuer said, well, since it's already appeared, but it was done, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, and they didn't explain the context, they just published it. He thought you had to publish it to let these people know the truth. But he wasn't going to publish it either, because for any rabbi to say that, in fact, let me read you what Katz says about this. Absolutely correct. Had this been published in the lifetime of the hold on a second here. Hirsch is very well respected, but had this been published, yeah, Katz discusses it on pages 273 and on. He says, let me read it to you. Exactly the words. There is no doubt that had Hirsch published this responsum, the Orthodox establishment in Hungary would have had no mercy upon their former ally, and would have dealt with Hirsch as a rebellious elder, Zakein Mamre. So the response was filed away. Had this ever been published, Hungarian Rabbanim would have declared Hirsch Michutz l'machane, out of the fold. Because any rabbi who's going to defend the status quo is regarded as out of the fold, as far as they're concerned. Now, it's true that many of the rabbis in Lithuania and Poland had very good relationships with the status quo rabbis. But to actually write a responsum or a letter to defend them and to say that what you're doing is fine and you don't need to join the Orthodox community, that they didn't do. And so Hirsch would have been seen here as undermining the entire battle for Orthodoxy in Hungary, and that would have been enough to make him as illegitimate rabbi. The Dayan of Satmar, of the status quo community, his name was Yitzhak Klein, and he published a Torah journal, went on for like 25 years. You can see it on Hebrew books, on Otzer Chochma. It's called Oel Yitzhak. And take a look in it. You have Rabbanim there, well-known Rabbanim from America, from Germany, from Poland, Lithuania, not from Hungary. Because no rabbi in Hungary, Orthodox rabbi, would contribute to a status quo Torah publication. All you have there are status quo rabbis, a few of them. But so the whole Torah publication is from outside Hungary. So if you look at 93, this is here, number 93 in Shemesh Marpeh, here says that what we did is not, has nothing to do with what you did. He said our issue was that we didn't want to be in a community with the reformers. And he says that, but you, your community, everything is continuing. How can he, here's his whole point in this long letter is, how can they say they're not a kosher community? You are the same today as you were last year, last week. You're following Torah and Shulchan Aruch. The fact that you don't want to belong to the Orthodox organization here says, I recommend not calling yourself status quo, because other communities who might not be Torah observant can also call themselves status quo. But he says, but you have nothing to do. It makes no sense what they're doing. And he says that they have no right. They're not in charge of you. You never joined the organizations. They can't tell you what you do. So the great irony is that the status quo, who are the worst, much worse than the neologues, because the neologues are regarded, they're not Torah observant. They're like liberal Jews who are traditional, but they're not Torah Shulchan Aruch Jews. So for them, okay. But it's like today, the Orthodox rabbis get a lot more upset with open Orthodoxy, because they see that open Orthodoxy is it's fraudulent. It's making believe it's Orthodox. So you have to come out. So that was the problem with the status quo. You had communities that on the face of it, you had Torah study and Talmidei Chachamim and everything. They have to be destroyed because they're not really Torah Jews, because they don't join with us. That's why the response was so harsh. And Hirsch's whole point was, who gives them the right? You're not they're subject to them. So one of the great ironies is that the great originator, really, and defender of Auschwitz, of separatism, he's the great defender of the status quo communities. Like I said, we could spend 20 classes going through the development of Orthodoxy in Hungary, including extremist Orthodoxy, because then the Orthodox in Hungary make, at least one part of the Orthodox make all sorts of decrees that you can't have a wedding in a synagogue, the machitza, you can't see the women. They have a whole group of decrees, and that splits Hungarian Orthodoxy as well. So it's a fascinating story, but and I know we have some Hungarians listening to us, but we do not have time to go into that, only because I want to get back to Bamberger, and maybe when we finish this, and maybe then I'm going to do the Musar dispute, and then I'm going to do Rav Shmuel Molliver, founder of one of the founders of Rude Zionism, and then I'm going to do the Langer case. Special request. Maybe then we'll come back to Auschwitz in Hungary, because what we take for granted is not really always the case. I want to show you one more thing. By the way, you come with me to Hungary this summer. I was there last summer and still was there. So let's see, it's been up now for like 10 years. Okay, so there's a number of restaurants. A lot of tourists. Israelis love Hungary for some reason, but there's a lot of, it's probably five kosher restaurants now. So you have different hashgachas, of course. So the most active community is Chabad. And Rabbi Oberlander, who's the Rav there, he doesn't come from Chabad, actually. He became Chabad, comes from Papa. But a huge, huge Talmud Chacham. You can see the video we did with him 2 years ago during COVID. An interview with him. And so his community, and there's a number of Chabad communities. It's a bit controversial if you follow the news, you know, because they're very aligned with the government. But huge Talmud Chacham, and he has Hashgacha on a few places. There's a couple of restaurants there. And then you have the community, the original community, the Ashkenazic, not Hasidic community, which still exists. And they have a restaurant also. It's called Hannah's, inside their center. And as you walk into there, if you look on the right, they have their institutions also. They have a sign there that the only restaurant under Orthodox supervision in Budapest is Hannah's. And so, in other words, but yet right next door, you have Carmel, you have all the different restaurants under Rabbi Oberlander. And look, you see all the frummies, the Hasidim, everyone going into them. So people always come up to me on the trip, what's going on? And if you read the Hebrew, the Hebrew says, as I recall, the only restaurant under the supervision of the Kehila Orthodoxy, that is the Orthodox community, is Hannah's. And in Hebrew, that is actually correct, because Hannah's is not under the supervision of the Orthodox community. The Orthodox community is the Kazinsi Chol, and it's Hannah's restaurant. The other restaurants are under the supervision of Rabbi Oberlander in the Chabad community. So technically it's correct in the Hebrew. In the English, though, for any one who doesn't know about this. I thought it was maybe by accident they did this, but someone else in Hungary said no, they knew exactly what they were doing. But if you're an American tourist and you go there and you read it and you say that only this restaurant, Hannah's, is under Orthodox supervision, then you're going to assume that the other restaurants are under conservative, or not. In other words, you will assume that they're not under Torah, halachic supervision. Because in America, we assume Orthodox is synonymous with Torah observant, reliable. But that's not the case in Hungary. When it says it's not under Orthodox supervision, all it means is it's not under the Orthodox kehillah. Chabad is not the Orthodox kehillah. Chabad is its own kehillah. I guess it's status quo, or whatever it's called. They don't have that anymore. But even with the Hungarians, I want to show you something, that even their extremism, just like in Germany with the rise of the Nazis, by the mid-1930s, the separatists, even though that was such a precious value to them, came to understand that when dealing with Hitler, you can't have separatism. You have to approach him as one unified community. You have to give them credit for coming to this conclusion. The same thing in Hungary. Here's a book. It's called Jewish Budapest, a wonderful book all about, look how thick this is, whole history of Jewish Budapest. And if you look on page 362, you see, dealing with 1939 after they called them the Jewish laws, in which Jews were discriminated against in Hungary. You had a number of laws. You have laws against Jews in business. Like, they wanted to do it by the population. You know, if you have, let's say, if you're only 6% of the population in Budapest, then only 6% of the university population should be Jews. Sound a little bit like DEI, if you ask me. Yeah. And also in the businesses, if the Jewish population is, let's say, 6% in Budapest, then Jewish doctors are like 20-25% in Budapest. So starting now, only like 6% should be, I think 6% was the number. So they had all these Jewish laws. On page 362 here, it quotes from all three Jewish communities, the Neo-Law, the Orthodox, and the status quo, wrote one joint communique sent to the parliament stating that this violates Hungarian constitution and is in contradiction with human rights, etc., etc. So you see that when push came to shove, the Orthodox was willing to go together with the non-Orthodox. And I say that because we had this rally in Washington, D.C., and you had certain people on the right who said that we absolutely cannot participate because our tradition is not to have anything to do with the non-Orthodox. The fact is that's not true. Yes, the tradition is generally not to have, but we know from Germany and from Hungary, and you can't get more extreme. Look, the rabbis running the right wing in America from Lithuania, where there wasn't even such a thing as separatism. But the real separatists, the ones in Germany and the ones in Hungary, faced with a Shas Adchak, an extreme circumstance, they were willing to come together because that's what a Shas Adchak is. You have regular run of the mill, and then you have an emergency. And so I guess I'll leave it to you to judge whether we're in an emergency situation today or not. But you see that even in Hungary, the Orthodox was willing to come together when they thought that it was an existential crisis, that Jewish livelihoods and the future of Judaism in Hungary was really at risk. I'm going to show you another book. I just thought of it, but Patriots Without a Homeland, Hungarian Jewish Orthodoxy from the Emancipation to the Holocaust, 2023. It's a fascinating book because people don't realize this. Hungarian Jews, including the Orthodox, were just like the German Orthodox. They were patriots. They felt Hungarian. I'm not talking about the ones, the Hasidim, who still spoke Yiddish and what we call Unterland, but the Jews in Pressburg, the Jews in Budapest, all over, they felt like they were part of the Hungarian people. It's like America, like Jews today, Orthodox. You could be very Orthodox. You feel like you're an American. Yeah, you're Orthodox, but you're Jewish, but you also feel like you're part of this country. I don't think in New Square you feel that way, but generally people feel that way. And that's how Hungarians, so for them, this was a great shock when now all of a sudden they see that they're not part of the Hungarian population, that they are separate. And they were willing, even in Hungary, the Orthodox, and the Orthodox in Hungary were even more extreme than the separatist Orthodox in Germany. They were willing to come together for the sake when they saw it as really an existential crisis. Auschwitz begins in Germany and moves into Hungary. Actually, Hungary doesn't need Germany. It's how it is. I guess independently it begins there. But it would then move after the war into the United States. Not technical Auschwitz, because we don't have kahilas. We don't have a situation where the government says you're in one group and therefore you have to withdraw. So there's no technical Auschwitz, but there's the ideology of Auschwitz, namely, how much do we cooperate? How much are we together in joint institutions? What we're going to do next class is we're going to focus on the American scene. Maybe we'll get into Eretz Yisrael a little bit as well, because Rav Kook is going to resurrect Rabbi Bamberger. And when I say resurrect or transfer him, I should say, but transfer him in a way that's not really authentic, because Rav Kook falls into the trap also that Rav Bamberger was like Rav Mordechai Horowitz, that actually believed as well in ideologically that the non-separatism was a value, a positive value. As we saw, that wasn't Bamberger's position. He said it's okay, but he's not arguing that this is the best approach. His Rabbi Horowitz, as we saw, he actually believed that, Rabbi Una and others. So we will, let me hold off on that for now, because that's going to take us a little while. Let me take some questions. I don't know if I'll be able to spend the whole time here. I'm waiting for my son. Believe it or not, he's getting in. I have to just text him. He's coming into the airport today. And if he's here now, I'm going to have to. No, he's not here. I'm going to tell him to. He'll text me when he gets out. Let me just tell him to text me. And then it's a half hour there. I'll have to shut it down, unfortunately. And then I'll go get him. But in the meantime, we're okay. So the first thing I see, and then I'll go to the beginning, is MJ Franco says, I shouldn't conflate response to crisis between real Hungarian Budapest style with the Marmarish hardcore in the northeast part of the country. Okay, I actually, before I even saw that, I did mention that afterwards, I assume this is after your point, that I'm not referring to the people you're talking about. I'm not referring to what becomes Transylvania, all that in Unterland. That's what Hartman in his book points out so well. You have to distinguish between the old-fashioned, maybe village Jews, whatever you want to call them, Hasidic ones who still spoke Yiddish and much more traditional, versus the ones who were in the western part of the country. And the problem with this book, Patriots on Homeland, is that it's very expensive. It's Academic Studies Press, like $130, so I didn't buy it. But I finished it in the last few days, and I really found it very eye-opening. Thank you, everyone, for hoping that my wrist be mended and fully functional. You ask, what makes a swordfish treif and a turkey kosher? Well, the question is, why should a turkey be kosher? Because we have a tradition, according to halacha, you need to have a masorah, a tradition on birds. So really, a turkey never should have been kosher. It got in through the back door. It was shipped from the New World, and people saw it, and some of them thought it came from India. It must have had a masorah. Others thought it was just a big chicken. In other words, it became accepted. And after it became accepted, and then people realized what it was, the post scheme, they said, well, there is an opinion that as long as it doesn't show that it's like a predator type of bird, that you can rely on simanim, even though that's not the accepted halacha. Once it was already accepted, then it, after the fact, they were melamed zchus. Some people didn't eat it, Tosfos Yom Tov's family, others, but we can rely on that for us today. Now, a swordfish treif, the question is, does it have the scales? And when the first issue came up, Rabbi Tendler was the one who made it treif. As far as I know, this is what I've been told, he never actually saw the swordfish then. He was relying on information he was given. No one saw a swordfish, but Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Savitsky went to the Boston Harbor, and he looked at a swordfish, and he declared, in Shabbos Agadol Drasha, or Shabbos Shuvah, I forget, I asked his son which one, and he declared it kosher. And then his son told me, however, that the Rebbetzin says she's not going to let it in the house. But Rabbi Soloveitchik said it's kosher, and they would eat. They still eat it to this day. They would eat it in Italy, in Morocco, in certain places, in Tetuan, he says. And so, look, Rav Schechter says it's kosher. So it's really interesting that Rav Schechter, who's the posek for the OU and the different VODs, why don't they bring it back? So we will see. But it's sociologically, it's not. The citation of the Rush available is, hold on a second, I'll give it to you, from Humberger's book. Yes, the citation is Gittin, Perek Daled Siman Zion. Rabbi Yellen points out to learn the full story of Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg and the Golem. Yes, Rabbi Schneer Lyman has done a lot of great work, but there's a new book. I think it's also expensive, but I got it free because I added a series. A Kabbalist in Montreal, The Life and Times of Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg.
It's now $40. It's now $40 on Amazon. It's gone down.
So $40 is hardcover. Okay, well, a little expensive itself, but at least you can get it. Yocheved testifies, Erosovich's wife, Odin Barrow. I'm assuming that's what, when Shaul Lieberman got together with Rabbi Soloveitchik privately, I assume they called him Barrow. Thank you, Paul, for pointing that out. A very colorful, yes, and grandfather Mordechai Richler. Also a great grandfather of Rabbi Shlomo Brody, who's appeared at Torah in Motion. My son got the book. I also got it, but my son says it's great. He came out with a book on Jewish military ethics. I highly recommend it based upon not having read it personally, but based upon knowing who Shlomo Brody is and what he's able to achieve. And also my son, who I respect his opinion a lot, my son Josh, he's reading it now. And my children, two of them had Rabbi Brody as a teacher in the Tikva program in Israel during a year in Israel. So he just came out with a book on Jewish military ethics, ethics of war, deals with civilian casualties. All he says in the introduction or the afterword that when he started writing it, people said it's going to be a very short book. And I understand why, because we don't really have so much in the halachic literature. But from what I skimmed, he has everything. The dispute of Rav Gorin and Rav Shaul Yisraeli about leaving during Beirut, leaving an area for them to escape, issues of civilian casualties, Rav Shaul Yisraeli. So, look, he wasn't planning on the book appearing now. We didn't know about this war, but it is very timely in Yonah Dioma.
Dr. Mark, a quick interruption just to let people know, because we're just got on the website in the last day or so. Rabbi Brody will be giving a 3-part series on his book beginning January 17th on this book on military ethics that you're talking about. So just to let everybody know that, and sign up soon for that class, maybe after this one. Okay, sorry to interrupt. You can go back.
Okay, I just have my son's at the airport, and I'm asking, can he wait till 10:10? And if so, I'll go get him. So Jacob says that most Syrian Charlies are Shaul. Interesting. Paul says that Sprinza is apparently corruption of Esperanza. By the way, the name Schneor, strange. Is that Senor? It seems to be from Senor, but how does that get from Senor to the Ashkenazim? There's been a lot of speculation about Schneor. Yentl. Yeah, Yentl. Humberger has something, as I recall, about the name Yentl. Nissen says, was not the Yiddish name given to the boy on the Shabbos when the mother returned to Shul weeks after the bris? Yes, that's the Holkreich, they had called it. They'd give the, you'd have the Hebrew name, and then you'd have the Shem Chol, and there was a whole ceremony. And that's what you were known as. If your name is, you were called.
Achen, what's it called? Achen, the name of the ceremony. The name of the ceremony.
Holkreich. Yeah.
One more time.
Holkreich. Thank you. Yeah. So Carla says the questioner in Hirsch's 19 letters is likely called Naftali. I never thought of that before. Naftali Hirsch. Okay. Very nice. So Barry says, when the immigrant groups came to America in the early 20th century, they only had a Hebrew name and they took a common English name. So his name was Yeshua, so he took Sam as an English name. Yes, that's why you'd have names that don't correspond. Look, my son's name is Joshua, but we named him after someone. But then his Hebrew name, I gave him Yair because I want to name him after someone else. So it is strange. Like, if his name is Joshua, it should be Yeshua. But I know other people have done the same thing. Joshua is a Shem Chol. I wasn't thinking Shem Chol, Shem Kodesh, but Joshua is Shem Chol, and his Shem Kodesh is Yair. What can I say? But I don't know where Rabbi Rosenberg gets the idea that Max is an Asher, and where he gets these, that name Max and Charlie. Dictionary of, thank you, Hadassah. Bider's book, Dictionary of Ashkenazi Given Names. Yeah. And Samuel says that in his hesed for the Rav, his brother Aaron called him Beryl. Okay. Thomas says a number of Jewish groups, veterans, right-wingers, also approach the Nazis to be considered an exception. Yeah, in my book on the on Rabbi Weinberg, chapter 5, I deal with some of them. You had a guy named Max Naumann, who was the head of an organization of national German Jews. And the Jewish war veterans said that it's okay for the Ostjuden, the East European Jews, to be treated like second class, as long as they, patriotic Germans, were treated as first class. No, when someone says about the trip tomorrow, someone says, yes, but if by January 3rd, if you sign up by the end of January and sign up by today, there's a super discount. If
tomorrow,
you miss today,
tomorrow.
But you still have a very nice discount.
No, basically, Mark, just to clarify, the early bird special goes till the 31st of January. We always do the first week. If you sign up by the 9th of January, tomorrow, there's an extra $200 off. Off the early bird special. That's
so it's a very, very generous and very wonderful discount.
It's also the least expensive of all our trips, by the way. This in Europe is the least expensive trip we run, just because of the nature of the trip. It's not any less luxurious. It's just it's easier to run. Yeah. Whatever.
And there's restaurants. A lot of the costs that trips are expensive is we have to hire caterers. But Baruch Hashem in Prague, in Budapest, in Vienna. We have restaurants, so it makes our life a lot easier. You usually have to rent a place. You know, hotels charge a fortune to rent a room and then bring a mashgiach in and a caterer. To do it in a restaurant saves a lot of money. Someone says, why do we lay in Yisachar and not Yisachar as written? There's different traditions about this. Some people, first of all, some people are given the name Yisachar, and that's what you should be called up to the Torah if that's your name, if that's your Hebrew name. It could not your shame call. But, there's different traditions. Some people lay in it Yisachar, except for a couple places they say Yisachar. According to the Masoretes, it's Yisachar. It's always Yisachar. But some traditions have developed. Now, why? The Masoretes the sin is silent. Why is it silent? We have a lot of it in English language. We have things are silent. If I say he brought this home, the G is silent. As far as I know, the Masoretes don't explain why it's silent. None of the Masoretic sources I know explain why it's silent. They just tell you it is silent. What I think they're saying is that there is a reading tradition. Maybe originally at one time it was pronounced, but there was a reading tradition that it fell out. And I guess maybe it was supposed to be a doubling. Yisachar, you double the sin. I think that's probably what it is, that it's a double sin. Like you put a dagesh.
It's the only place in Hebrew that it is a double sin. There is nothing else.
Yeah.
Only there.
So I think probably that's the answer that, they kept it in. We have other places where you have a doubling and we lose the doubling and we have a dagesh. But, I don't want to say anything because I know that certain Hasidic groups that they, I think until one place in the Torah, they do it Yisachar and then they change it. And everyone knows it's the B'nai Yisachar. So, I know people in the Hasidic world, their name is not Yisachar, it's Yisachar. I don't know in Israel today. I don't know if David Eisen's with us in Israel. First of all, does anyone get the name Yisachar in Israel? But they're called Yisachar or Yisachar, I guess you'd say. Yeah.
Rabbi Yonah, you go through and have me laying Yisachar only when he's born. I believe that's the Minchas Shai's approach.
Only when he's born. Okay. I don't know. Yeah. I don't think it's a Minchas Shai. I take that back. I don't know if it's a Minchas Shai's, but that's
what Rabbi would do.
Rabbi Yonah says years ago there was a similar sign in Prague. You referred to King Solomon. I don't know if the sign is still there. In Prague, last time there's two Hashgachas. You have the community Hashgacha, the Orthodox community, the rabbi in Prague, but then you also have Hashgacha by the rabbi of Berno, who's actually our tour guide, Menashe Clement. And they're both Orthodox, but one is the community. Although when you were there, Rabbi Yavon, it might have been, there used to be Chul Chasam Sofer used to come in during the summer from B'nai Brak, and they would give the Hashgacha on King Solomon. And then I think, then Rabbi Clement was doing it for them. Now he just does it himself. Yes, right. Paul is correct. Rabbi Slifkin served swordfish. But what's more significant, Paul, is that it was under the Rabbanut of Jerusalem he served it. That is the Rabbanut of Jerusalem, which generally does not give Hashgacha to swordfish. in you don't find it in Jerusalem, but they do believe the Yeshmael Mili Smoch, that there's what to rely on, and for his event they served they did it. I'm not talking about sorry Sefkin. If they probably did for Sefkin also, the first one to do was Rabbi Zivotofsky. Rabbi Zivotofsky was the first one to do one of these pseudos and halachic pseudo. Then Rabbi Sefkin followed after that, but it was Rabbi Zivotofsky who he told me that the Rabbanut of Jerusalem did it. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Oh, Rabbi Brody's teaching now, I think, right? So everyone should sign
starting
up.
Starting on the 17th of January. Class starting the 17th.
Okay, very nice. I highly recommend. And he now is head of the organization for organ donation. It's called Amatai. They changed the name from Halachic Organ Donor Society. And Dov says that his parents always called him Berish. Okay, Berish, Beryl, they're all the same. Incidentally, how do you spell the name Dov? Do you spell it? The Rav always spelled it with a Vav, I think, right? I'm confused now. In Tanakh is without the Vav, right? And I believe, hold on, I'll check it. I believe the Rav always spelled it. I'm looking at, you have to look because they get it right on the title pages of all the Sfarim, as I recall. Yeah, no, the Rav spelled it full with the Vav. I don't know if it matters in terms of Gittin or anything, how you spell it, but there's a tradition. Where did I see it? I saw something online. I forget now if the tradition is with the Vav or without the Vav, but there's a tradition about Masadri Gittin of how to write it. Okay, I see my son still waiting for his luggage, but I see we've run out of questions here and comments. I don't get MJ Frank or Yob in Yashuv. I don't know what he's referring to, but I thank you all for coming out. Let me just say again, if people email me, it's very hard. So be patient. I'll try to get to all of you. Say welcome back, Rabbi Kelman, from your trip to Eretz Yisrael.
Thank you.
Sure, I got, was yes, and important.
Yeah, that's right. I got back last night. Listen, in New York, you're lucky you have a direct flight. It took me 23 hours to get home because no direct flights to Canada. So I stopped in Heathrow, whatever, and got home 9:30. Was in class today at 8:30 teaching. So Baruch Hashem, and I'm a little tired, but okay. Glad to be back. But it was it's a very powerful trip. Hopefully, I'll get a chance to write about it. But it's very very moving. I don't know how many people here have been
and I have to run, everyone. I have to go to the airport. I have two children who got back from Israel yesterday. Well, yesterday, one today, and one who's on the flight right now to Israel. It's important. We got to do our part.
Yeah,
okay, good night,
Israelis,
everyone.
The Israelis really, really appreciate that we come. That's everybody thanked us like 100 times over for coming. And then we'll talk about it. Anyways, I'm not here to talk about trip, but it was very moving, inspiring, depressing, all at the same time. Lots of heroic stuff going on and lots of sad things to see and people to meet. And, you know, what can I tell you? On the surface, it looks normal. Below this, or, you know, in Jerusalem, restaurants are open. People are going to work. People are around. But you talk to people. It's a tough situation, but please God, it'll be good. Okay, I mean, Mark just mentioned, so I figured they did get back last night. It was a very, been to Israel many times, but I think all of us know this, it's different now. The world's a different world since October 7th, anyways. All right, we should hear good news, and if you can go to Israel, I think it is a great idea. There are solidarity missions basically all the time, and I think that's all who's going. All the people tell us, the only people who come really, everybody's coming on missions, they basically all have a similar form. You spend a day in the Gaza envelope, visit the kibbutzim and et cetera. And one day in Yerushalayim and one day in Tel Aviv. That's sort of what we do. And anyways, okay. But back at Torah in Motion tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman.
We found the series for you to sponsor. I just texted.
As I'm sure many of you know, Shuli Mishkan starting Kuhner series on the gates of Gaza on Wednesday. We're having Yosef Lindell starting a new series on Monday. Rabbi Brody, we have a number of series. We'll send out the full list. I think it's on the website already, but we'll send it out the next day or so. And everybody be well. We should hear good news. And okay, Lalit Tov, everybody. Everybody's so quiet. I'm listening quiet. Okay, but everybody be well. Okay.
Thank you. Be well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Okay. Laila Tov.
He wrote a book. And...